Hello, hello. This is Osman with the House Einstein podcast. This is podcast number 13, Mountain Property Due Diligence. And with me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello.
All right. Happy Friday. Let's get after it. Happy Friday to everyone who's listening to this. We're recording it on Friday, June 23rd, but you may not be listening to it for a while longer. And given that we have a number of mountain properties currently listed or in the works, and it's an area of real estate that is often, challenging. I felt like it was a very good podcast topic for today. And agents specialize in the mountains. Some are jack of all trades. Particularly, I find mountain listings interesting because they're so unique. And the types of things that buyers should be thinking about when they are looking for a property in the mountains, it is the due diligence for those properties goes much deeper, much, much deeper than an ordinary home down in the valley and down in the city of Boulder or in Denver. So this really applies to all mountain properties, this topic area. And it really is a specialization, or at a minimum, you want to make sure whoever's advising you has had some experience in mountain properties. And before we get too far down that rabbit hole, let me add our usual disclaimer that if I'm not your real estate agent and we're not having a conversation about your situation, then this is not real estate advice to you. I am a licensed real estate agent here in the state of Colorado, and I have a background in investment, finance, and due diligence as well that predates real estate. But for CYA purposes, our attorneys would like us to remind you that you should work with the professional of your choice, and that I'm not that professional unless we've already engaged in that relationship, and in which case you should contact me directly and not rely on a podcast. And for everyone else listening, the best way to think about this podcast is humor, and Hamish and I will do our best to live up to that to some extent.
And if you are reaching out to contact, you can find Osman at houseeinstein.com.
That's right. Thank you, Hamish. That if you are looking for us, you'll find us at houseeinstein.com. My contact information for now, direct contact information is everywhere on our socials, on our website. But we also have an amazing team here at House Einstein. So it's not just me. There's a group of us all working to help you make a smarter real estate decision. Okay, let's talk That is what we do. Let's talk about mountain property.
Awesome. Whew.
The number of horror stories I have, it fills a pretty thick file. But today we're going to talk about a variety of topics. We're going to talk about fire risk, the cost to insure. We're going to talk about water quality issues, and then some of the less than commonly expected issues like living on dirt roads and maintenance of those dirt roads. Some of the unique communities that you find in neighbors, mountain people, so to speak, that live not in town, and wildlife issues, as well as some kind of typical quality of life issues when you're driving into town for restaurants and groceries. So we're going to hit on all of these topics and hopefully give you a good overview on what you need to know when it comes to buying or selling mountain property, and whether that applies to Boulder, Colorado, where we are now, or your hometown. It's probably very similar.
Osman, I was going to ask, do you have any interesting stories from your home purchase? You're up in the mountains.
I do.
Additionally, internet to the due diligence.
Oh, good point. Communications. Yeah. Although that has changed a little bit in recent years. So mm-hmm. Let's make sure we touch on that. I'd like to keep my neighbors friendly, but let's just say that the neighbors in the mountains, there's a reason they may not want to live next to other people. Right. And so it's not that they're antisocial, but they may just prefer privacy. And so that's something to keep in mind if you're buying a home in the mountains, that you're not going to have the same suburban experience or city experience of living in town, where the neighbors really do know each other and can be very much in your business or not, but often are. And here in the mountains, the sense I get, the vibe I get, is people generally prefer privacy and then limited engagement on their terms. And the specific stories I'm going to skip, because I do live in the mountains. In fact, where I'm recording right now is in Four-Mile Canyon, at the very top of Four-Mile Canyon, and actually really adore my neighbors. They've been wonderful. They grow vegetables in their greenhouse, and they bring them out to share with us in the summer and fall. We share snow plowing duties. You know, in rural communities, people rely on each other more. And I think there's that also to keep in mind, that people on one hand want privacy, on the other hand, take care of each other in a way that may go a little bit beyond what you might find in a city. When I lived in New York City years ago, and I worked for an investment bank in Midtown, I didn't meet my neighbor. Literally, we shared a wall, and I met her the week I was moving out.
Wow.
And I was rather astounded, but I still remember it because she had a dramatic porcelain doll collection. It was an elderly lady. And she had like cases and cases of porcelain dolls, porcelain decorations and figurines, and not my thing. But not still, I remember it just because of what a passion she had for it. And I kind of wish I had met her before the week I was moving out.
You know, it's somewhat counterintuitive. You have these high density areas and most people are strangers to one another. And then when you get more rural, that sense of community is a lot stronger.
But they may still want privacy. And it's like it's a dichotomy, right? Do you want privacy or do you want to know your neighbors? And in true high density living, like in New York City, I feel like it's actually a higher chance you may not meet your neighbors for a very long time than living in a rural area. And then the suburban areas or a small town like Boulder, small city like Boulder, somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boulder tends to, at this point, have a few sections where people would know each other or have their own community, but as a whole, it's still got that kind of separation of a big city.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. My impression so far. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first topic on the list is fire. And that's often what most people think about when they're considering mountain property. And it's a valid, concern. Colorado has seen many wildfires. And in fact, my house that I'm in right now is rebuilt from scratch from a home that completely was destroyed in the Four-Mile fire. As a consequence, we're surrounded by burn scar, which I think reduces our fire risk. But interestingly enough, insurance doesn't look at it quite the same way. However, there are programs out there to increase your mitigation, to encourage mitigation, to even fund mitigation. And some of those programs are required to reduce your insurance costs. But increasingly, insurers are canceling policies in high fire risk areas. And in fact, our policy was canceled and is canceled effective September. And I scrambled and found a new policy. And it's actually at a lower rate with a much more well-known carrier, but it required a mitigation evaluation by Wildfire Partners, which we passed with flying colors. And
nice.
And so I'm excited to actually have our insurance drop this year while many people we know are losing their insurance. But insurance companies assign a fire risk score to property. And then based on the asset value and that fire risk score, they will either pursue a policy or decline to provide one. And in the state of Colorado, recently the legislature passed some legislation to allow for a state fire insurance entity of last resort. I haven't seen any news about that other than I believe it was signed by Governor Polis. And I expect some sort of relief to be coming shortly based on that for people that are losing their insurance policies due to all the fires. But we're even seeing it in town. In Newlands, one of our clients who recently acquired a home found that there were challenges to getting a policy because of how close Newlands is to what's called the Wildland Urban Interface.
I'm not sure.
This is that place where nature and suburbia, or nature and homes start to blend together. And I think it's wildland urban interface. I may have to look that up. I don't.
Real estate Hamish, agents call it Google, open space.
Well, and open space is an entirely other topic. Real estate agents call almost anything that doesn't have a house on it open space. But this is where, you know, what do we say? Hamish, can you Google that? Wildland urban interface while I'm chatting. You know, look that up, Jamie. I mean, Hamish.
It is. You're correct. It's called WUI.
WUI.
W-U-I. Yeah.
So if you're close to the WUI, you have much higher insurance costs, or you may not even find a carrier if your home is a multi-million dollar home like you'll find in Newlands. And we did talk about this to some extent on our Dakota Ridge video, which is another neighborhood that is literally surrounded on three sides by wildland urban interface. And I've never heard an agent talk about that before, but 100%, not only does it increase your cost of ownership, it also increases your sense of insecurity in living here, right? So, 2 weeks after we bought this house, there was a fire. It might be the Calwoods fire. And that fire plume was on the hillside past us and blowing to the southeast. And we had our housewarming party that day. And we spent all that time looking at the fire plume and worrying about our house burning. And within 3 days, we actually self-evacuated, not because we were ordered to, but because it just made sense. We weren't sleeping. And if the wind direction changed, we were just concerned that we would find ourselves with a panic evacuation. And why not just evacuate to our family's house in Denver for a few days and let this blow over? It also forced me to talk to insurance and find out what's covered and what's not. I evacuated motorcycles, a cargo trailer, cars. But the house, everything in the house was covered. But interestingly enough, vehicles are not, at least by our policy at the time. So we chose to evacuate what was not covered, which is very strange. But that's what we did.
I mean, that's another point, right, is if you're going to be living in an area where there's known kind of fire danger or where it's always a possibility, you also need to have a plan. You've got to kind of do some extra due diligence and put together your own evacuation plan, and, you know, personal property protection, stuff like that. So,
That's right. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And Leah just sent, actually. So Leah's my wife, and we've been talking about this for years, but actually didn't come up with a plan until recently. And when we had our wildfire urban partners, partners up here, one of their questions was, "What do you have a fire evacuation plan? What is it?" And even if it's not the perfect plan, you need a plan. During the Marshall fire, a number of my clients, I think it's like five of them, have lost their homes in that fire. And I called one of them because I knew she had little kids and she works during the day, and the husband also works, neither of them at home, and they have a babysitter. And I was like, you know, their house is in direct
line
of fire. Right. And I called her twice. She picked up and she's like, "What's up?" And I'm like, "You know about the fire?" She's like, "What fire?" I'm like, "There's a fire. Oh, it's heading toward your neighborhood. You should evacuate your kids now." And later that day, she texted me and she was really thankful because I was the first person who notified her. She had no idea what was happening.
Wow.
So it's not just people in the mountains that need a fire evacuation plan. It's actually everybody that lives in Colorado because of the high risk of wind-blown fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, emergency contingency plans should be a standard for everyone. I'd just say more so in the mountains.
That's right.
And, you know, very front of the mind. I think is massively on the front of the mind of most Colorado residents now after the Marshall Fire, too.
It is 100%, thankfully, in our awareness. And some people say that it's related to climate change. I think they're probably right. It's kind of hard to argue it's not. But it gets really dry here. It can get really windy. And in the event of fire, it can spread very quickly. And in which case, there's nothing you can do to fight it other than to get out of its way. So buying a home in the mountains means having more acute awareness of fire risk. And there's a lot of homes, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about the spectrum of home quality. But some of the older homes look like a matchbox to me. Like, it's dry. It's all wood siding. It's surrounded by trees that are very close and could crown directly onto the structure itself. There's no fire mitigation system inside the house. There's no sprinkler system. That kind of property to me is like, needs to be scored lower on the desirability scale, or priced more appropriately for what it is relative to newer homes. And this is something that often is overlooked by agents when they're out there pricing houses, that some of these older structures that you see listed at high dollars haven't been updated in decades and are definitely not built for fire mitigation, versus the newer homes with concrete siding board or stucco siding, metal roofs, sprinkler systems, clear land around the property that has nothing that can burn. That all is very helpful. But in the event of like the Marshall Fire, again, almost no structure is going to survive.
Mm. Yeah. The Marshall Fire was a brutal one.
Yeah. Well, the guy that came up here to do the evaluation, Wildfire Partners, told me that, look, even he has seen homes. This guy is a retired firefighter in his 70s. And I guess he was an engineer before. Like, he's had two careers. And he said he's seen homes that were concrete that burned. Mm-hmm. And it's because the windows melted when 2,000 degree heat is blasting against it, and the home burned from the inside out. There were embers that went through the windows that burned, and that set the home on fire.
And at 2,000 degrees, everything's flammable at that point.
Exactly. And well, concrete probably isn't, but yes, everything inside the home is probably burnable. So there's no safe answer to life, right? Life is a terminal event. There's no zero risks choice when anything happens in life. And real estate is one of those things where there is no zero risk option. But for sure, your risk is higher in the mountains. And your risk is, if you're farther from a fire station, your wildfire score will be higher. And you may find it challenging to find insurance. And at a minimum, you should expect it to cost twice, if not three times, what a similarly valued structure would cost in town.
Yeah.
To insure. Yeah.
And that's a conversation with yourself, right? Like, what's your risk tolerance? Is there a trade-off? Why do you want to be in the mountains? You know, is it something you can navigate? And I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast or watching us on YouTube, you're somewhat interested in mountain properties and the due diligence associated. So it's likely you've had that conversation, and we're just trying to bring even more things to consider to the table.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And when I worked for an investment company, and we were trying to take this company public, this group, this operating group public, I'll never forget the way that one of my colleagues described the process. And so this was a leasing company, right? It was an aircraft leasing company. And the owners were very risk averse, and it was a constant battle to try to push the ball forward. And he called our meetings the Johnny Camp lease meetings for all the ways that this won't work, right, is what we were constantly looking for. And it, you know, let's talk about the flip side of that. You know, Johnny can't buy a house in the mountains, or shouldn't buy a house in the mountains. Let's talk about why people buy houses in the mountains.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I feel like there's a spectrum between the people that watch The Shining and the people that grew up with John Denver. and there's some overlap perhaps with both, but for sure, I think that John Denver in the 70s really was the first global marketing of the Colorado lifestyle. And the Colorado lifestyle is still here. We have amazing weather. We have beautiful mountains. We have beautiful skiing. Year round, we have activities in the mountains. We have a very short mud season. Unlike where I started in real estate on Nantucket, where the market was shut down for like 8 months, here the market is shut down for a couple of weeks during mud season. It's a phenomenal place to live. And the things that attract people here are that high quality of life, a major regional airport, fantastic educational resources in Colorado, still relatively low taxes, and a progressive openness to our social structure. Like we're not particularly conservative, although there's still a farm and ranch and mining element here that may be a little more conservative than you'll find in other parts of the country. But overall, we're pretty liberal live and let live state. I mean, we were one of the first to legalize marijuana. We were one of the first to legalize psilocybin mushrooms, or at least decriminalize these things. Yeah. And clearly, Colorado is a young state.
It's working for it. It's working
and
for
it's,
it. You know?
It's working for us. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So where were we? We were talking about John Denver, and we were talking about The Shining.
Yeah.
So some people just are not interested in Colorado because of this fear that you need a snowcat to get to your house in the winter, and Jack Torrance might come through the door in the mountains because there's crazy people here. And the other side of the population grew up with this romantic image of the other side of the spectrum is this romantic image of Colorado that John Denver portrayed in all of his music and his lifestyle and even his videos. And a lot of that is still very much true. Now, downtown Denver and even Boulder is not the same thing as living in the mountains. But when you buy a home in the foothills, like where I am, you can kind of get a little bit of both. You get the amazing restaurants. You get the cultural events. I'm in the city of Boulder every single day, it seems. I have a 15 to 20 minute drive to get to downtown Boulder, and that drive is actually pretty pleasant. As we've shared in other podcasts, we're car guys, and so a twisty mountain road is actually a lot of fun to drive. It's also incredibly popular with cyclists, so I'm always very cognizant of that and careful. But for sure, it's a fun drive, and it's a drive where I'm not stuck on a highway in stop and go traffic, which I would say is an aggravating drive. Yeah. So as long as I plan for my trips, it's been perfectly fine. And it's a nice balance between living in town and living in the romantic vision of what it's like to live in Colorado.
There was a decent amount of, I think it was construction last year, maybe the year before on Kenyon. How was that?
thank you. It's sort of funny, right? Like they say this about relationships. The human mind tends to forget the bad and remember the good. And for sure, when I first bought the house for the first 6 months, there was a construction project on Canyon that made the travel time unpredictable.
Mm.
So as a consequence, we would often route over Poor Man, which is another canyon, and go down Sunshine, which is another canyon road, rather than go down Boulder Canyon Drive. It added about 5 minutes, but it was a consistent 5 minutes.
Yeah, right.
And
you
knew
the consistency
that I could plan my meetings that way, but it was completely inconsistent if I went down Boulder Canyon. That construction project's now complete, and so is the construction project on Sugarloaf that was at the base where it meets Boulder Canyon Drive. And so both of those projects are now done, but it doesn't mean that we won't have a car accident or some other event that takes out part of the road. And that's definitely part of living in the mountains is you may have a creative commute at times.
Yeah. So alternate routes maybe would be a good consideration there, right? You've got Canyon and then you were able to use Sunshine.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there have been times where they've closed Boulder Canyon and people are driving up 4 Mile, crossing our road, getting on a Sugarloaf, and then driving up to Ned. So they've added half an hour to get up to Nederland. So it's not just these two canyons. It's also the town of Nederland that's affected by Boulder Canyon Drive. And if for some reason the canyon's closed, you could add an hour to your commute time.
Easy.
But there are routes that get you there. You just have to plan in advance. And it's part of mountain living is the additional time that you're driving to the airport, the time that you're driving to Whole Foods or Costco. And if you're in my business, the time you're driving for work, but you could, a lot of people work remotely, so it's not actually as much of an issue if they only have to be in the office a couple of days a week.
And you've been saying too, Boulder's been work from home pre-pandemic, one of the larger work from home populations.
That's right. And and before there were people were limited in their broadband choices. And when we first moved here, we had CenturyLink, which was horrifically slow and unreliable. And we upgraded to Starlink, which is what I'm on right now. And except during peak periods of time, it's tolerable. And if I want to erase that peak period issue, I can throw more money at it. because Starlink has the ability to guarantee higher quality service. So we're on the base service, and it's more than adequate for my work. It's much better than CenturyLink. But if I was day trading or something like that and really had to guarantee a high quality connection, you pay an extra $50 a month and Starlink will give you higher bandwidth. No brainer.
Is it competitively priced? At least
no.
Close enough? No.
No.
Not the extra close. Service, but your base pricing with CenturyLink.
And so that's something. Oh, the base pricing with CenturyLink was the same. Starlink is about twice the cost of CenturyLink. And then you could add another $50 a month if you want the super high speed version. So it's not cheap. Nothing in living in the mountains is cheap. You will pay more for fuel or energy if you're on an EV to get up and down the mountain. You will pay more for insurance. You will pay more in terms of your psychological well-being and fire risk. And you'll pay more for internet. But you won't pay more for, you know, overall well-being because, you know, net-net, the peace, the spiritual beauty and tranquility, the hiking trails out your front door, the social trails that are hidden in the woods, that stuff is only found in the mountains. And in my view, it's very difficult to replicate that unless you have a giant lot in town. And in which case you're talking about not it costing a lot more, because at the current time, the mountains are actually quite a bit cheaper than the city of Boulder for the equivalent house. We've seen some $3 and $4 million listings to put, you know, a dart at pricing, and the same equivalent house up here in the mountains is half that cost or less. And it's just astounding what you get, but you have to live with these trade-offs. You have to do your due diligence around things like fire and insurance. But let's keep going down the list.
Yeah. I mean, we've been seamlessly hitting it, you know, just high quality podcasters over here.
Well, I want to keep an eye on the time too, because we're roughly at 25 minutes or so, and I want to keep this to about an hour. I love our long form podcast too that I listen to, but at some point you kind of wish they edited it a little bit.
Occasionally, yeah, when the conversation gets a little dry. Right. So we've been hitting convenience. Do you want to hit into the restaurant and grocery side of things?
Well, actually, I was going to talk about water quality. So I'm just going to kind of work down this a little bit. So most agents will recommend you do a well test when you buy a house. And that well test is mostly around a recharge rate for how quickly your well refills with water. And if your recharge rate is low, there are solutions. You throw money at it and you can have a cistern and a secondary pump so that the cistern fills slowly. But when you need water on demand for washing or for showering or the family's all getting ready at the same time, you don't drain the well. So that's the option for slower recharge rates. But what they don't tell you is that you should always test the quality of your water well beyond the basic panel. So Colorado has had multiple experiences with fire retardant, and this has been a huge problem in the Springs, where they use these things in training for the military, but also up here where they sprayed PFAS-containing chemicals on the ground to stop or slow down the fire. And that those chemicals often contained what are sometimes called forever chemicals. The retardant contained forever chemicals, and that stuff has leached into the groundwater in certain places. So if you're buying in the mountains, you should 100% test your water, and you should probably expect to install a reverse osmosis and remineralization system anyway, because the water is usually hard and you may not want to be drinking hard water. So you probably need a water softener to take out all those minerals, but then you don't want pure water either in an RO system because that leaches the calcium out of your bones. So you don't want that. So you have to think about water before you buy a home in the mountains, and you should 100% test, and you should plan for a mitigation system. If not just a water softener, also an RO and reverse mineralization system. You should just expect it. And whether you choose to test for PFAS or not, it's up to you. Those tests are not quite as available and are much more expensive, but in fact, they could be more expensive than just installing an inexpensive under sink RO system, which is what we've had, although we're now looking at a whole house system just for convenience, because our water tested with high nitrate, which was unexpected. And some people think nitrate's great as a performance booster. There's like a disease called blue baby syndrome associated with it. We don't really know where the nitrate's coming from. It could be our neighbor's got a leaching system, which is kind of gross to think about, but that could be where the nitrate's coming from. In any event, we have an undersink RO system, and I think it was like $500 and a couple of hours to install. The most painful part was getting somebody to cut the granite.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Goodbye, countertop.
Nobody wanted to drive up here to do it. And interestingly enough, it was somebody else I had come up here for something plumbing related. And I happened to ask the guy, do you cut granite? He's like, sure. And I'm like, well, how much would you cut to do this? He's like, I can't remember what we paid, but it was very reasonable. And it just happened to be he was up here. But there were nobody wanted to make a special trip just to cut a hole in a countertop.
You got to get him for something else and then rope it in at the end.
Well, yeah. I mean, and what's funny is actually this is while we're on this topic, all the contractors that you are used to working with in the city of Boulder, about half of them won't work in the mountains.
Mm.
Maybe more than half. So that's the another difficulty is expect challenges when you need contractors, when you need a plumber, when you need a handyman. They may not be willing to work in the mountains.
And or an extra fee just for getting up there, yeah.
And or an extra fee if they're willing to charge you that. So those are the, you know, those are the kinds of things that surprise people. The biggest thing that surprises people in my experience has been winter. So we've helped a lot of buyers over the years, Hamish. This is way even before your time. And I would say about half of them after a few years realize that this is not for them. And sometimes it's the wind and winter that lasts a month or two longer, particularly the further up you go in elevation. But sometimes it's also the fact that they've children that are in sports and they're driving up and down the mountain two times a day to their kids in. That's going to do it really quickly.
Hmm.
So those types of things are conversations that are really for your agent to ask if they're a good agent, because I mean, look, some agents really all they care about is the money, but honestly, I feel bad if we sell somebody a house and there's a quality of life issue that we didn't tell them about as a risk factor. And they decide that's not going to work for them because of this thing that we could have warned them about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Make a smarter decision, right? Not just get them in the house.
Well, ideally they're in the house for 5 to 7 years if we're representing them on the buy side. If we're on the sell side, ideally we've done everything we can to position the home correctly and make sure we don't go under contract with a buyer that discovers an obvious issue and terminates on us, like cost to insure. Mm-hmm. We want to present a list of insurance agents that have product for you. That way we're not relying on a buyer's agent who may not have those relationships to advise their client on insurance. And we do that before you accept the offer. But when we're on the buy side, for sure, I feel bad if our client within 2 years is like, man, I'm just sick of winter up here in Netherland. And I want to be down in town where it's sunny and warm and not freezing and windy up in Netherland. So, I mean, not that Netherland is all freezing in winter, but Netherland is definitely colder. And in certain parts of Netherland are also windier. It depends on where you are in the mountain topography. So that's another due diligence item, is to think about wind.
Mm-hmm.
And the day you go see the house and the day you inspect the house, it may not be a windy day, but those older structures were not built with the same levels of wind load engineering than new homes are. And they really move in the wind.
Oh, I bet they creak.
Oh, yeah. They creak. The whole structure shakes. I've been tracking wind up here, and often we'll see wind gusts that are 20 to 40 miles an hour more than you're seeing in town.
Hmm.
And so within the first 2 months of buying the house that we're on, because we do have wind exposure, I had installed hurricane anchors for our shed. We moved it to open the view, and we have a cargo trailer up here. I created anchors in the ground with concrete for the cargo trailer, and the cargo trailer has moved I have it chained to those hurricane anchors because I don't want to find it halfway down the hill because the wind has blown it.
Yeah. So I've got a question. How do you deal with propane? Do you have a delivery that comes up occasionally? Almost every mountain property that I've seen always has, you know, this massive propane tank over on the side of it. What's the kind of situation there?
That's right. And so we have a pretty big tank, and we've been getting away with filling it once a year. Others have smaller tanks, and they have to fill it multiple times a year. So on a regular basis, I wander out to the tank, and I open the lid, and I look at the gauge, and I tap the gauge with the lid to make sure it's not stuck, and see how we're doing. And that has been very interesting, but it also encourages us to be more judicious in our energy usage. This house also has solar hot water and radiant heating, and that has been amazing. Our energy bills are about, if you averaged out the course of a year, are about $100 a month to heat this house, just for heating, not electric. Our electric has gone up because we have EVs, and as a COVID release valve or relief valve, we installed a hot water tub, the hot tub. And the hot tub burns a lot of juice.
I believe it. Well, it's impressive. I'm in a 1,300 square foot kind of townhome in Westminster, and our energy bills are $100 a month, or heating, sorry. So during the winter time. So that's impressive because you have a lot more square footage.
Yeah, I think this house is like 3,600 square feet or something like that, maybe 3,300 square feet. We also, it's also compartmentalized. So this is something to think about from heating systems. Zones and doors are really, really useful because you have rooms that you don't use all the time. So why are you heating it to 68 degrees like the rest of the house? Or whatever temperature you would like, why not keep that room at 55 degrees unless you're using it? And so that's what we do. We have zones in this house that are pretty intelligently designed. The former owner was an engineer, is an engineer who worked on the Hubble. And this house is well, this one thing I really like about this house is how well designed it is from an engineering perspective. Aesthetically, you know, it's great. I love this house, but there's a lot of newer, hipper looking homes that are much more modern, right? That look like art museums.
It's not front page of the magazine, but it works great.
It's a fantastic house. It's understated. I'm deeply grateful for this home that we found it when we did. And we got it for a reasonable price before prices really expanded dramatically. We got it before the last two big bumps in price, so I feel really good about it. It didn't come without a lot of additional due diligence. And for example, it was clear that this road is not – well, it wasn't clear at the showing. Who maintains this road? And about half the road is maintained by Boulder County, but the other half is maintained by the residents. And because we're at the near the top – we plow all the way down to where the county maintains. And so as a consequence, before even closing, I had bought a plow truck. And a month later, after closing, I had got a company to install a plow on said plow truck. And I plow about 2 miles of dirt road in the winter when it's more than a couple of inches of snow. Otherwise, the roads get really bad and muddy and messy if we don't plow them. If we plow them, they dry really fast. That brown dirt melts the snow all around it, and it's actually not an issue getting up here with snow tires and four-wheel drive.
And that's, the segue into another thing is dirt roads. You've had issues with clearance in the past.
Oh, you had to remind me of that.
I did.
You did. I had taken that bad memory out of my memory bank. Okay. All right.
Bringing it back. Yep.
So it's not just who maintains the road, although that should be one of your first questions when you're looking at a property. One of our listings right now is maintained by a HOA that grades it, has signage on it, even puts down additional material to keep it dry and not pothole filled. And it's very inexpensive for that HOA. Another one of our listings right now is the beneficiary of an HOA that maintains the neighborhood before it. And then there's a driveway that may be about, oh, I don't know, 500 feet long, 700 feet long, yeah, that the owner's responsible for. That's a very nice compromise to have the HOA of the adjacent neighborhood covering your road. And at some point, the county may start to maintain the upper part of this road because it is an escape corridor to the next canyon over. And it's starting to get pretty eroded, pretty rough. It's going to need a grading. And it would be lovely to have that be a shared expense with the entire county instead of me and our neighbors sharing the cost of grading and the time and energy involved in snow plowing. Although snow plowing is actually kind of fun, I have to admit.
It's grown on you.
It's grown on me. You'll see some of that on my Instagram, the plowing. Well, I grew up with plowing a long driveway and that sort of thing. It just feels, it's kind of fun. You get out in nature. It's like beautiful powder. You do it early while the snow is light and fluffy. And it's actually, you know, you see the people snowshoeing and hiking with their dogs and skiing down the mountain while you're plowing it. It's really fun.
Do you have skiers up there where you are?
Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
Oh, yeah. Cross country mostly, although sometimes there are tracks of people that have gone through, you know, the ravines and the steeps. So it's not just cross country. But yeah. Oh. Yeah. But that dirt can damage your vehicle, as you were alluding to. And in a very spirited moment of driving a very low slung car, we had some damage to that car on the oil pan, and that was really annoying. I fixed it, but I had to fix it in my driveway in the garage. And it was, you know, I hit a bump and it just hit, the rock hit the oil pan and cracked it. And so that can happen. Your sports cars are out, right? The low slung cars are probably not the best bet, depending on the road, right? Our listing that's currently on Sugarloaf, I don't think that'd be a problem for most cars. But my road could be a problem. I think you need a little more ground clearance. A Subaru Forester, a Subaru Outback is plenty. You don't need a monster truck to get up here. An ordinary car with a little bit of ground clearance is better. But the other factor is your cars are constantly covered with mud and dirt. And that's just a fact of life of living in the mountains. So if you are a car person like we are, Hamish, that is painful to never have a clean car. But you just kind of get used to it and you accept it as one of those trade-offs. Wash it as regularly as you can.
Yeah. And that's, you know, when we coordinate pickups of certain equipment on and off, it's now, you know, I'll meet you at the base of the entire driveway where the concrete meets the dirt.
Right.
And that's just a little consideration that we've been working with.
Yeah, that's right. And that seems like a fair trade-off to not make people drive up here. This road also scares people. I've had people that that don't like the exposure, even though the road is, you're not going to slide off the road unless you lose control of your vehicle. But if you do slide off the road,
it's a bit steep.
It's a long way down. Yeah. It's a long way. My house is about 2,000 feet in elevation above the city of Boulder. And so elevation, again, is something you do want to think about. And winter access is something you do want to think about. And whether the decision makers, the people that are going to be driving vehicles, teenagers maybe that are living in the helm, can they handle driving this road in the winter? That's something to really keep in mind. And it's not for everyone. Personally, I don't think it's a big deal. But I know and I recognize others do. And so I'm cognizant of that. We don't schedule dinner parties up here in the winter because you just never know what the roads are going to be like if we're getting a storm in. Now, I will say, right, that again, trade-offs, wildlife. It feels like we're in a snow globe when it snows up here. It is absolutely beautiful. Deer, elk, moose, mountain lions, foxes. We've seen all sorts of animals up here, and they're beautiful. And I feel very lucky to have them as neighbors, and I recognize we're living in their environment.
And they're largely unafraid, so too, aren't they, up there?
I don't know. I did not have a direct bear conflict, but the fox was unafraid. That was very strange.
Yeah.
The fox was like just another human and kind of kept walking. That was a fun experience.
That's great.
These animal encounters are just beautiful experiences up here, mostly. But the mice that live up here are not a beautiful experience. We're doing our best. I hate killing animals unnecessarily, but between the mice and me, if they're in my space, they're done. So we're going to actually work on resealing the garage, because I think they're sneaking in around the garage door. Because we're trapping mice in the garage right now, and I'm not crazy about it. It's like one every other day.
Wow.
For the last week or two, and that's getting to be a lot of dead mice. So I'm going to go look at foaming in the garage a little bit more, because I can see likely where they're coming in. So those are the things, positive and negative, wildlife exposure. If you have little kids or a dog that likes to be off leash, you can't just let your dog out at night off leash.
No.
To go use the bathroom. You may never see that animal again, because there are kitties up here. Big kitties.
Hungry kitties.
Hungry kitties. If you're a small or younger human, you too could be prey to being attacked. Now, I think it's been a really long time since there have been a fatal mountain lion attack of a human in Colorado, but certainly is not going to be a fun experience for you.
Or something you really want to stress about, right?
And that's the thing, right? Like, even though you know it's extremely unlikely, I too walk with a little pepper spray bottle, like a tiny little keychain one. It probably is not worth its weight, but even though it's light, but at least it's something, mm-hmm. right? Like, if we suddenly have a kitty encounter, and most likely it'll be a young cat that doesn't know what it's doing, and it might be accidental, I want to have something to defend myself with. And I ask Leah, my wife, to also carry that when she's out hiking or running up here, because especially at
you know,
prime kitty hours, dusk and dawn.
Those are shark hours too. I grew up on the beach, so that's how I know them. Yeah. I'll say we kind of alluded to like different communities and different types of neighbors, right? And I can feel like, I don't want to create a false dichotomy, but it kind of boils down to like, you have the people that move to the mountains for the views and for the serenity. And then you have the people that moved up to the mountains to get away from other people. And I mean, they're both enjoying the views and serenity, but you may end up with a neighbor that just really doesn't want to know you.
You might. I mean, I think it's better to just give everyone a chance.
Oh yeah.
And be aware that some people like their privacy up here. We're not Montana with a bunch of, you know, militia people.
Bug outs. Or, right? Yeah.
And that's a rumor too. I'm sure if you went up to Montana, you would find that the vast majority of people living in the mountains are not sitting there toting guns and aiming them at you if you pull into their driveway. But you do, I think it's just smart to be aware that people like their privacy and you should be careful with how you engage with your neighbors. In any case, whether you're in town or you're not, you should always be judicious in how you engage with your neighbors. So we've talked about insurance. We've talked about water. We've talked about dirt roads. We've talked a little bit about mountain people, self-reliant individualists, rugged folk, and some of the mountain community stuff, like up in Gold Hill, the Gold Hill Inn, the Mercantile up in Jamestown. These community centers are really vibrant and people know each other in a way that's much more intimate than in larger communities. And we talked about the wildlife. Now, we haven't really talked about restaurants and groceries. And you'd think, well, no big deal. But most people don't even think about it, right? You're used to ordering every now and then and having food delivered. And that doesn't really happen up here in the mountains. Now, I say that. Well, knowing I personally have pulled out of the snowbank a poor DoorDasher.
Who, really?
I can't believe my neighbor ordered DoorDash. Like, this is just irresponsible behavior in wintertime, asking some poor DoorDasher to come up here who has no idea what they're doing and where they're going.
Yeah.
And who knows if they even had four-wheel drive. The guy was just sliding all over the road. And then we had the neighbors got together and you know, got the food delivery done. But it was also like this WTF moment, like, neighbors. Don't really? Order up here. Like, you can't order food delivery in the snowstorm up here. You shouldn't order food delivery anyway up here. It's such a long drive. So that's the thing, right? We can't easily get to a restaurant, easily get to a grocery store. We can't really get food delivery. So you have to plan. But, you know, there's flip sides to that. We eat healthier because we're cooking most of our own meals. When we go to the grocery store, we plan more carefully because we don't want – we don't have – when I lived in Martin Acres – and in North Boulder, I could be in a grocery store within 5 minutes. Like, it was so fast that you didn't need to even stock up. But up here, we have a chest freezer. We buy in quantity and we plan ahead as much as possible. We still find ourselves sometimes just so busy that we're eating in town and then coming up the hill, but we definitely eat out a lot less and we're more organized in our grocery shopping. And that's a requirement for living in the mountains.
I bet you save a little bit too in that respect, right? Like, you know, a little bit more bulk, a little bit more planned. Makes sense.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Save a lot, Hamish. Mm-hmm. I mean, restaurants are expensive, especially with mandatory tipping, even in coffee shops. Like our food bill probably is half of what it was when we lived in town.
Yeah. No, the positives.
And I'll also add the quality of the food is better too. Mm-hmm. So from a diet nutrition perspective, you have control over the ingredients. So you're not putting in a bunch of sugar and a bunch of things that you don't want in the meal. And you have tighter control over your calorie intake as well versus going to a restaurant. I mean, sometimes the portion sizes are just out of control. And I love Boulder restaurants. We're huge fans of the Suns, Mountain and Southern Sun, Under the Sun. We're huge fans of lots of other restaurants in town, the Indian restaurants, Tandoori. But it's healthier for us to make our own food.
Always. Yeah. You know how much sugar you're putting in, right? You can watch it.
Well, also whole ingredients, organic ingredients. So the other thing to think about is the quality spectrum. So we touched on this a little bit, and I want to get into it again.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think it's much wider anecdotally. And, you know, I love data, but anecdotally, this quality spectrum is much wider in the mountains than what you'll find in town. And you'll also find more unpermitted activity up in the mountains. And the pricing of some of these homes is sometimes just complete guesswork by the agent. Like we have, you know, these two mountain listings, and I've been astounded. These are what's happening right now, these two, a third one on the way. I'm just astounded how often other agents are listing a home and not visiting the competitors. And if you don't visit the competitors, you have no idea what you're benchmarking against. And we do. We always visit the competition to see where we should price the home appropriately. This is how I could tell the differences. So there's a home in the 90s. I'm not going to give the address because it's a deal currently in play. That's not very far from one of our listings. And it's, you know, it's so dated in terms of its design. It has what I can see as zero fire mitigation. Right? Like it's got trees really close to it and all the siding is wood and all the siding looks dry. And yet it's priced not far off where we are. And the difference is that that home is about 5, maybe 7 minutes closer to the city of Boulder.
Mm.
But just driving an extra 7 minutes, there was so much more value in our listing that's currently on South Peak. That's an amazing house from a design and fire mitigation perspective and energy efficiency perspective, that has stunning views. But I don't think the buyers of that home, that's its competitor under contract, actually came up the hill. Or maybe they were topped out because we are priced a little bit more. But in my opinion, well worth looking at the difference because the value you were getting at this higher price listing is astounding.
And the peace of mind.
But we often see these, I don't know, I hate to call it
peace of mind
term, but I'm just... Yeah. I'm just gonna say it. Like there are often crap shacks up here, that literally you're buying the dirt value, and it will cost you money to remove this structure that is so poorly designed. I mean, think about it from a car ownership perspective. Again, a '70s car might have some romantic value until you go drive it around every day,
mm-hmm.
and then you realize that even compared to like a car from the '90s or the early aughts, the early 2000s. Like the generational differences between vehicles is astounding. And the same thing is true with the generational differences in housing, in custom homes, which is usually what you see in the mountains. A home built in the 70s is not even close to a home built in the early 2000s. From an engineering perspective, from a design perspective, from a fire safety perspective, it is night and day.
Toxicity.
Low ceilings, toxicity, right, lead-based paint, other factors in the home. It is just night and day, and yet it is so rarely talked about. So this is the spectrum that people need to consider when they're looking at mountain homes, whether they're buying or selling, and like when they're trying to price it and market it. Some homes have amazing protected views. Others don't. Others could have a neighbor next door in a month or two. All of that comes into play. In fact, one of our recent closings, the reason they bought that land was to prevent development next door that would destroy their quality of life. And for a few hundred thousand dollars, they locked that down. And they now also have the money as a bank account for future development because that lot has what's called a buildable lot determination. So that's one more piece.
Nice.
And this particularly relates to land that often agents are going to market the tranquility of your amazing 20 acres of land in the Colorado Mountains that does not have a buildable lot determination. And their job is not to tell you that. It's your job and your buyer's agent's job to warn you that this home cannot support a structure.
Or this land.
Does not have a built, but it's just land. You need 35 acres because of the law that was passed in the 70s around development at the state level. And if you don't have that in unincorporated areas, you're not going to be able to build what you think you can build. There's also all these other layers of restrictions. You're not allowed to build on a ridge, right? Like the county actively discourages construction in the mountains. You're also not allowed to build larger than a percentage over the median size of your neighbors. And guess who gets to decide who your neighbors are? The county. So it doesn't matter if you have
it's
a
very arbitrary
lot.
Yeah,
it's totally arbitrary. You could have a 200 acre lot and not see any other homes from your house. And they could tell you that you're not allowed to build a 5,000 square foot house because all of your neighbors have mining cabins from the 1940s. And they're all under 2,000 square feet. So your median size is 1,800.
Have fun.
And you're allowed to build 120% of that. So that's it. You're not allowed to build. In fact, you're already nonconforming and you're not getting a permit. Sorry. See ya.
This sounds personal, Austin.
I've just heard this story too many times. Also, you're not allowed to build a garage, but you could build an ag structure. But you better not be parking your RV up there. It doesn't matter if we can't see it. We're coming after you if we find you've been parking your RV in your garage. And I'm sorry, your ag building. So there are all these restrictions to development in the mountains that go way beyond what you'll see in town. In town, the restrictions for development are largely understood, or it should be. Honestly, there's a lot of agents that don't even know what they're doing with that. But some do, and the good ones do, and they should warn you. But in the mountains, it's even more complicated. And the answers are not easy. And any agent that says it's easy either is inexperienced or is intentionally misleading you.
Sounds right.
You make it a note.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Mountain development is another factor in your due diligence. And so if your investment thesis involves development, and that includes an addition on your home, you better have checked this out before you close the deal and before your contingency expires in the contract. And there are contingencies to protect you. You should do your homework and make sure that you've protected yourself and with the appropriate due diligence with development.
And plan a reasonable time to, you know, vet these contingencies as well. You know, there's going to be a lot more back and forth for these mountain properties and their due diligence than, you know, a 1 week kind of contingency process down in the valley.
I mean, you should build into the contract a longer time period. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, with this property, we knew we were likely going to have survey issues. And that's another item on your due diligence list, is that often mountain property is not surveyed. And the more difficult the lot looks to survey, the more expensive it will be and the more reasons why it's not surveyed. So if the listing agent is all, hey man, sorry, it's not surveyed. That just is what it is. Don't worry about it. You should really worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to plunk down $40,000 for a survey, but you do need to reach reasonable comfort level with what this lot really is. And so, for example, there's a house on Hurricane Hill in Nederland that we put under contract before we bought this house, and we terminated that deal. And it wasn't on survey. I ended up walking the entire lot and finding the survey markers myself and looking at it on multiple maps and overlaying them and getting comfortable, because this lot was shaped like a guitar. It was such a weird shape. But it had 11 and a half acres. It had killer views of the reservoir. And you were just outside the town limits of Nederland, which meant that you could short-term rent it much easier than you could in the city of Nederland. And at the time, I don't even think the county had short-term rental restrictions. So all of that was plus, 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 check, check, check. There were some question marks, like the driveway had a really tight hairpin. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty clear that if a fire truck was going to come up there, it would have to pull out the fence posts.
Oh.
Right. So that was, we could probably live with the fire truck issue and the plowing issue, because that was a weird, twisty driveway. But then what killed that deal was actually not the survey. It was because the owner did a whole bunch of unpermitted development. Mm. They built a beautiful, stunning deck, which was a key selling point of the property. And they also added a master bedroom suite on stilts, no less. And neither the deck or the master bedroom suite were permitted. They did it in the middle of the night. And I went down the rabbit hole on this property deep. And I built a file. And I thought about mailing this file to the current owner. But I also don't want to get my nose into it, because we terminated that contract because of the unpermitted structures. And the funniest part was, in the permit file, there was clearly a negotiation that had happened in the 70s. And the owner was allowed, first it was noted that the owner bulldozed a road without a permit, and bulldozed a road without even the neighbor's permission. Like, they went through other lots and bulldozed a road. Okay. And then the guy files his permit, and in this negotiation, so they solved the road issue. They had traded a garage for the deck. So the home was built above a garage. Well, guess what? He then built a deck as soon as the permit was closed. It wasn't supposed to have a deck. And the master bedroom suite wasn't even on the thing.
They were like, we're doing whatever we want.
We're doing what we want. We're in the mountains. So this is before satellites. This is before drones. And they got away with it until the ball's going to fall onto somebody for this. And unlike a simple unpermitted basement, Hamish, this is a big deal, because the county is probably going to make us tear all of the unpermitted work out if we ever file for a permit that's substantive. And our investment thesis involved turning this 2,200 square foot house into something that was more like 3,000 to 4,000 square feet, something that would upmarket the property. And ultimately, we weren't going to do that day one, but it totally killed that investment thesis, because we would have spent at the time another $100,000 just deconstructing things and bringing it back to cabin size.
And appeasing so you could get more permits.
Appeasing. Well, we were also then bumping against the home size limit based on the neighbors. And we did that homework too. So all of that is part of due diligence. I spent a lot of time looking at mining claims in the county offices to try to piece together where these lots were. And so that adds the last piece. And we're coming up on, we're coming up on an hour, and this is on mines. So this is the last piece that you may want to think about. And Colorado has a history of mining. And some of these mines have left behind toxic tailings. And some of these mines have standing water full of heavy metal. And you need to know about it. And there's also a safety risk with mines. So we have 12 nieces and nephews. And the nearest mine to us is partially fenced. It is not on our land, but it is 100% strolling distance from our back door. And so I think about it with respect to we both think about it with respect to the dogs, with respect to children. And I also worry, you know, sometimes an animal is going to fall into this thing, because it's not just there's a horizontal entrance that's about 500 feet lower, and there's a vertical air shaft up top. And the vertical air shaft keeps me up at night. And at some point I'm going to try to figure out how to get something that blocks it, because it is dangerous.
Yeah.
I originally was concerned that, you know, is there like a giant empty hole under our house, and one day we're all going to fall into the hole? I'm not so worried about that now, because of how rocky this whole land is. Mm-hmm. Like, it is rock everywhere, but I am worried about, someday seeing, an animal fall in or a family member get hurt. And that's got to get fixed. So don't forget to look for mine shafts and understand the history of mining in the mountains if you're buying a home in the mountains.
Yeah. All this to say, I think, you know, it mostly goes without saying the desirability of having a mountain home, you know, that serenity, the views, the peace, the tranquility, and then you do have that benefit of kind of building a community with your neighbors. These are just things that people often don't think about that are very real considerations to the quality of your life while you're in the mountains.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I come back to John Denver. The vision he sang about in the 70s is still here.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes, so he was well known for racing around the mountains in his bright yellow Porsche 911. I don't know much about that car, by the way, but he was known for that. That vision's here too. The twisties are fun. The mountains are beautiful. They are spiritually renewing. It is peaceful. It is a different living experience. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to live in the mountains. But it also comes with a lot of costs. And we kissed a lot of frogs, including that property on Hurricane Hill in Nederland, before we found this property. And when we did, and we had done our homework, we didn't wait. We had the offer the same day we showed it to ourselves. My wife and I scheduled a showing, and we agreed we're buying this one. On the way down, there's cars coming up. One car we recognized as another buyer.
Oh, no.
Because I knew the guy, and I'm like, uh-oh. Like, this is Boulder. It's a small town. Literally, by the time we got home, we knew what our offer terms would be. And despite really, really wanting it, I had to negotiate some sort of discount. I just can't help myself. And they laughed, but they gave us $5,000 off. So you know what? We got it for a really good deal. I tried to get the snowplow truck. They refused to sell that. But at the end of the day, the sellers were really gracious. They were very kind people. And we were the right buyers for this home. And sometimes as a seller, you have to wait for the right buyer who doesn't just tolerate muddy road and plowing and that sort of thing, fire risk, but can totally thrive in it, is totally fine with it, and knows what they're getting, eyes wide open. Mm-hmm. That's the key. And so many buyers don't go in with eyes wide open, and so many sellers misprice and mismarket because they don't understand how to distinguish their home properly. So, you know, whether we're serving buyers or sellers, mountain property is something we definitely want to do a lot more of. And I'm really enjoying the process, but every deal I learn something new, and it's like, wow, did not expect that to be an issue. All right, then.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun with these listings coming up and the ones we have.
Absolutely. And all of them, by the way, are fantastic properties. I think they're priced right. We're marketing the heck out of them, and we're really positioning them well in the competition for mountain homes. But rates have risen, and the mountain home market is slower. So actually, if you're a cash buyer, now's an amazing opportunity. There are more homes available than there have been in a long time, and there's quite a few interesting ones. So if you're out there shopping to buy or sell, reach out to us. We're happy to advise you on your real estate situation. There's no initial obligation when we start working together. Let's just get to know each other and see if there's a good fit. I mean, our goal at House Einstein is to help our clients make smart decisions, and we act as advisors, not as salespeople, with either side, buy or sell. We're really trying our best to help our clients maximize their real estate situation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for listening.
Deeply appreciate it. I love the feedback we're getting from real estate agents, from potential buyers and sellers. And if you're looking for us, you'll find us at houseeinstein.com. And don't hesitate to drop us a line if you enjoyed the podcast or if you hated it. Let us know how we're doing, and we're always seeking to get better. So thanks again, and we'll catch you next time.